From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, this is Due South on WUNC. I'm Jeff Tabiri. When it comes to providing resources and support to youth in need of mental health care, North Carolina could do a lot better. The state ranks 42nd in the country with the highest need and lowest access to mental health care for the youth. More than 10% of children between the ages of 3 and 17 now have a diagnosis of anxiety or depression, and suicide is now the second leading cause of death for children in North Carolina between the ages of 10 and 18. In particularly severe cases, children are referred to psychiatric residential treatment facilities, known as PRTFs. That's an acronym you're going to hear frequently this hour, PRTF. And we're going to spend this hour trying to better understand the state's youth mental health crisis and focus in on those PRTF facilities, which just may serve as both a solution and a contributor to some of these health problems. Here with me in studio are Jason DeBruin of WUNC, who spent a year reporting on PRTFs with support from USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism 2023 Data Fellowship, Holly Stiles, Assistant Legal Director for Litigation for Disability Rights North Carolina, and Paul Lanier, Professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Social Work and Principal Investigator for the school's Behavioral Health Springboard, as well as a co-director of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services and Systems Research at the UNC Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research. Welcome to Due South.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, glad to be here.
We're going to get to PRTFs in a little while. We're going to learn a lot more about those. I want to take just a minute off the top to get a sense of the overall landscape of youth mental health in this country and in this state. Where do you begin to try to synthesize and size that up?
There's just not enough investment in mental health. I think one thing we're going to hear over and over is that there's still this big gulf between physical health and mental health. And there's just a lot more investment in physical health than there is on the mental side. And that has sort of just a lot of consequences. Hospitals, including UNC, are happy to tout all the investments they make in cancer centers and heart and vascular hospitals. But there's just not commensurate funding when it comes to treating mental and behavioral health. And that's just true across the board.
Yeah.
And it gets only worse when you go into rural areas.
Paul, I mentioned a moment ago that 42nd ranking, North Carolina in the country's context, it sounds jarring to my ear. This issue is not unique to North Carolina, though, or is it? Is North Carolina an outlier, or does it kind of represent a greater sense of what's happening nationally?
Yeah, those rankings put out by Mental Health America have been pretty consistent over the past few years, with North Carolina ranking 40 or higher on the lower end in terms of mental health for youth in general. And so, you know, while we have, you know, comparable rates of mental health disorders among youth in our state, what we do see is lack of access and quality of care metrics that far are much lower than other states, similar to North Carolina across the nation.
Yeah. Holly, you've been in this space for a while. How did we get to where we are? Because my perception as a layperson and an outsider is that this conversation, this topic, is presenting a greater problem impacting a greater number of people than it was when you, as one example, began in this space.
Well, what we know is North Carolina dropped from 30th to 42nd for access to mental health care for youth since 2015. So we are doing worse than we did in the past, and it does have to do with investment. Where do we spend our money, time, and resources? What are we trying to make better and improve upon? And in North Carolina, community-based mental health services had not been a focus of improvement.
We're going to talk about community efforts and community efforts that exist or do not exist or maybe could improve here a little bit later on in the show. We know, and if we don't know, we're going to remind you now, that these mental health challenges exist on a spectrum. They can present in a number of ways, and I want to kind of get a sense of that spectrum from you all. Paul, I think I'll pivot and throw this out to you here first, but I want to hear from everybody. Give me a range of what this spectrum is as we're talking about mental health challenges for North Carolina youth.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, the opportunity to step back and think about, you know, mental wellness more broadly. We're going to focus in on disorders and the issues that bring people to the attention of, medical providers. But in general, this is something we all experience, how we feel about ourselves, how we deal with stressful situations. And most importantly, mental health for humans is about social connections and relationships. And childhood is a period of time where we're figuring all of these things out. So mental health affects all kids in North Carolina. Every parent, every grandparent listening to this should be thinking about the mental wellness of their child. Getting a grasp of how the size of this population can be difficult from a research perspective, but we have some pretty good survey data that they collect year after year across the nation and also in North Carolina to try to understand, how many kids are affected by these disorders. So in North Carolina, the most recent survey shows about 500,000 kids in North Carolina have a diagnosed mental health condition. And just for reference, that's approximately 25 PNC arenas full of kids. You have things like ADHD, anxiety, depression that tend to be the more common disorders we see. But again, roughly about 1 in 4 kids out of our 2 million kids in North Carolina are experiencing some sort of diagnosed mental health challenge.
1 in 4. I said off the top it was greater than one in 10. It certainly is greater than 1 in 10. 1 in 4. Okay, so that's and not to diminish it in any way, but some of the more common challenges, anxiety, depression, ADHD. Jason, go next level for us as we think about some of the psychiatric challenges that don't affect as many people but are a much greater hindrance on living a normal, quote-unquote, life.
Yeah, so there's a smaller subset, obviously, but some kids do suffer from diagnosable illnesses like bipolar or sometimes even something as severe as schizophrenia, right? We're not talking about a lot of people, of course, but these are children that obviously require a lot of additional care. And there's just, as we've been saying, that care is just not available, particularly in community. And so, again, I'll sort of make a comparison to physical health, right? I mean, if there's a child with type 1 diabetes, that child needs pretty regular care, insulin, right? And if that child doesn't get that care, then that's going to result in a pretty severe episode at some point down the line when the kids may be 12, 13, 14, 15, who knows, doesn't really matter. It's definitely going to happen, and that kid's going to end up in the hospital. Well, the same is true for children that experience anxiety, depression, diagnosable conditions like this. If they are not treated on a regular basis, the way, just again, think of maybe like insulin, that's going to result in a severe episode on down the line, perhaps as severe as something like a suicide attempt. And that's what we're seeing more and more often. And in some of my reporting, I found that a lot of times a child's first interaction with the healthcare system is when they arrive at an emergency room for a suicide attempt. I mean, again, for comparison, that would be the same as if a kid with diabetes went into shock and wound up at an ER, and that was their first ever time that they entered the healthcare system. And that's just sort of crazy to think about because of course that wouldn't happen. And yet that happens on a regular basis with children with anxiety, depression, PTSD, a lot of trauma. A lot of this can be encapsulated as trauma, that's affecting them and then in severe ways.
Jason DeBruin here on Due South along with Holly Stiles and Paul Lanier. We're talking about youth mental health today. We have a panel and we're talking about a range of things. I want to build, if only briefly, on something you were just saying, Jason. But Paul, a word first from you before that thought slips out of your head.
Sure. No, I just, Jason's totally right. The idea of, as a parent, I'm going to have to take my child to the emergency department because I am out of options and I'm so concerned about their well-being and what's going to happen next that I'm going to go to an ED. So in North Carolina, it's about 4,000 kids per year. So 10 a day showing up in emergency departments. And this data is from like the COVID era, and we're trying to avoid going to emergency departments and hospitals at all costs, right? And this is a huge increase since the before COVID era. So this is a major issue.
Holly, it seems to me what Jason's talking about, he uses the example of somebody who has type 1 diabetes. Another example would be if you have a cracked bone in your foot or something, if you're in pain, if something is wrong, you seek medical care. But if young people, children, are going to the ED for the first time after an attempt to harm themselves, there clearly is a lack of preventive care, a lack of maintaining care. And it would seem to me that there's a lack of potentially access here. Talk to me about the lack of access.
Yeah, North Carolina definitely has a shortage of individuals who are both just mental health providers, but also who focus on children. So that's a lack of access for children to mental health care. But then when you add into that, Medicaid insures a lot of North Carolina children, and providers who accept Medicaid and provide mental health care and provide mental health care to children on Medicaid, that's an even smaller pool of people who are available to help these kids. But just like with the medical care model you're describing, there should be, an urgent care, there should be an emergency department, and there should be a family doctor. And we don't have that same continuum of care available for mental health as we do in the medical model.
And it's even worse in rural areas. I mean, a lot of our listeners are in the Triangle area, and certainly the need exists here. But if you go sort of along that I-95 corridor, I mean, there are entire counties that don't even have a single licensed psychiatrist, right? There are schools that do not have nearly enough school counselors to identify these issues early on. And so then they just continue to fester and fester until, again, it results in some sort of a crisis event.
Jason DeBruin is WUNC Supervising Editor for Digital News. Holly Stiles is Assistant Legal Director for Litigation for Disability Rights NC. And Paul Lanier is Professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Social Work. We're just getting started here on Due South, discussing youth mental health, some of its challenges, and potentially some of the reforms. We'll be right back on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Welcome back to Due South. I'm Jeff Tiberi. We're talking about youth mental health in North Carolina this hour, and I'm here with Jason DeBruin of WUNC, Holly Stiles of Disability Rights NC, and Paul Lanier from the UNC School of Social Work. I just want to address something that we had talked about in the A segment a few moments ago, talked about North Carolina's ranking of 42nd as it pertained to kind of a narrow segment of this. That particular ranking, Paul, as you pointed out during the break, is actually improved. But the rankings are fluid, and there are different rankings here. Just touch on that briefly, if you would.
Yeah, sure. And trying to rank, among states is always, a difficult task. It appears, from the Mental Health America data that's just been released for this year, is that North Carolina has shown improvements from our consistent kind of 40 rankings. Looking at the indicators, they look at how many youth have depression each year, how many have substance use disorder, and then how many get treatment. And so what it looks like from the data so far is that, North Carolina is getting closer to other states in terms of, how many youth are being diagnosed with these issues that they're tracking, but we still fall far behind other states in terms of access to care, consistency of treatment, things like that. I also want to point out that NC Child, one of our most trusted sources here in North Carolina, gave North Carolina an F in terms of youth mental health. So the rankings are what they are. I think internally we still have, to be very critical in looking at our own data within the state versus comparing ourselves to other states.
I think it's worth being critical in these points. Holly?
Yeah, and from, an advocacy perspective, we certainly haven't had a decrease in phone calls about people having issues accessing care or being placed in institutional care. So the rankings are certainly data-driven, but the human stories have certainly not changed in any significant way.
Right. 1 in 4 children have some sort of diagnosis at this point in time in North Carolina, mental health diagnosis. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among 10 to 18-year-olds, as has already been mentioned here earlier in the show. As we think about the gradations, and we're going to step, I guess, from depression or anxiety, ADHD, to some of the more severe psychiatric challenges. Jason, what happens when things escalate, when a young person is in crisis beyond maybe, I don't want to say run-of-the-mill, but beyond some of the more traditional and widespread true challenges that we think about, but when it goes a step beyond that?
So the highest level of care that we offer in the state is in the psychiatric residential treatment facilities. And as the name suggests, they are residential. Kids will spend weeks, sometimes months, oftentimes months, I should say, in one of these facilities. They are oftentimes closed where parents can't even get in to say hi and see their kids except for at prescribed hours. Holly will talk about this a lot more, but they've been described as prison-like, not as therapeutic. But this was basically what my investigation was all about over these past 6 months or so, is that at the highest level of need, oftentimes kids are experiencing more trauma than they experienced even before they went in. And I think that's what's most concerning is that we were talking about all these needs for community-based care, and of course all that's true. But when we do have the most significant cases and where the need is the highest, oftentimes we're seeing just care that is not meeting the mark. And many times where kids, again, are experiencing more trauma at the facility than they were prior to that. And I'm going to beat this drum this whole hour compared to physical health. Just imagine if somebody went to a hospital with a broken bone and came out with like two broken bones. You know, that just sort of is crazy to even think about. But that's in some cases what's happening in these facilities where kids are, and I'm going to use the term warehoused. That's what a lot of people say happens here, where kids are effectively sent and more or less just kept away from the other population. And they're too easily dismissed as just quote unquote problem children that need to be sent away somewhere.
Right.
But they're not getting the care they need.
So we're going to spend several moments on this thread of it, because as I got ready for this show, this was something I thought I'm missing something here. I'm not getting this quite accurately. And my mind also went to institutions of 60, 70, 80 years ago, you know, children who have mental challenges, children who have cognitive disabilities. They used to get sent away to institutions because they'll never be normal. And please push back on this quick statement here. The vast majority of people we're talking about, with the proper care and support, they can live quote-unquote normal lives. They could go to high school. They could hold a job. Many of them could live on their own. Now, if we don't give them the proper treatment, they're never going to get there. But some of these disabilities are not necessarily a death sentence or they should be locked away. Can you just all affirm that for me real quick?
Maybe it's really interesting. I want to kick it to Dr. Lanier on this one. His research shows that a lot of the children that are in these facilities have a diagnosis of disruptive behavior disorder. And I think a lot of experts will tell you that a diagnosis of disruptive behavior disorder, which is a legitimate psychiatric diagnosis, can actually be treated in the community. In the community, in the home, and you can see really good outcomes. I'll maybe kick it over to you. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about what your research shows in that area.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's about 50% have this diagnosis of a disruptive behavior disorder. You know, compared to, and this is when we're looking at Medicaid data for the state of North Carolina over the past 5 years or so, you know, relative to psychotic disorders, which is 2%. So that definitely, Jason was saying, these definitely occur. But these are, you know, often, you know, we think about mental health conditions as like externalizing or internalizing disorders, right? And sometimes they show up together. But, you know, a lot of cases we see kids who have these externalizing behaviors that are can be very challenging to treat in the community setting when there's not appropriate supports in place. So, yeah, it's like a broken bone in the healthcare setting. I get that. But these are chronic conditions, not acute conditions, right?
Sure.
So like other health conditions, we have figured out ways to not have people have to sit in hospitals or institutions to manage them over years and years and years, right? And there's no reason why we couldn't think we could do the same thing with chronic mental health conditions that we haven't improved in the past 60 or 70 years
right. Is
embarrassing.
And the feasibility, the cost, the efficiency, the productivity – locking people away, that's my term here. I mean, they're not locking them away. We're going to get back to that in a second. But those are not – that's not a real treatment path, right? Like what you're saying is a holistic way of care across a long view is how people are going to improve and be treated and exist in society.
There is zero evidence that residential treatment facilities, PRTFs specifically, are an effective way to treat mental health conditions for youth or for adults, period.
Holly, I need to better understand this because, again, layperson in here, you all are the experts. If a child has some form of psychiatric disability, challenge, and they are in one of these PRTFs, to what extent can parents, an aunt or an uncle, a loved one, can the tribe, the village that collectively raises children, can they go and interact and engage with these children while they're there?
So the facility itself controls visitation, and it is the comparison of prisons remain true, which is, you know, there's visiting hours, and you can't just show up and ask to visit your loved one just whenever you choose. You're on their schedule. You can't go past the staff door and see where the child is actually spending most of their day. These are locked facilities, by and large. So they're not a place that is inviting the community in. Quite the opposite. They're trying to keep the community out.
Okay.
And I want to add, Dr. Lanier said, you know, these are not an evidence-based approach to treatment. And so we keep making this comparison to medical health because mental health and medical health should be treated the same in a lot of ways. And so, for example, if there's a treatment for cancer that has been shown not to be effective, it would be totally normal and natural to say, well, we should stop offering that treatment. We're wasting money on that treatment. And we know that PRTFs are ineffective and they are not a model that works for kids with behavioral challenges and disabilities. And yet we continue to spend that money, hundreds of millions of dollars, on treatment that we know doesn't work. That's a waste of our taxpayer money of the tallest kind.
I think I have another follow-up, I guess, on the authority of this here. Okay, I'm a father. I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, and I don't abuse my children. But I can, I guess, objectively speaking, I can look at a situation and say, oh, okay, that's a child who has a, you know, a psychiatric label, and they have a parent who is not helping and maybe adding trauma to this situation. And we don't want that child to be near that parent. There's an issue of abuse here. Okay. But I need somebody to explain to me who grants the authority for children to be locked up, as you all are saying, and no one to have access to them. Like, is this a state law? Is this from the North Carolina Medical Board? I'm having a hard time understanding who says this is in the best interest of the child. Maybe some bad parents, but to not give them access to anybody who loves them in this trying time, I just don't understand it. I need somebody to explain it to me, please.
There are certain things that can't be explained, so I'll just leave it at that on that issue. But the authority to place children in these facilities, voluntary placements have to go through a certificate of need. So essentially, somebody had to confirm that the child has a psychiatric diagnosis and that they would somehow benefit from a highly structured 24-hour environment. And that's in the Medicaid clinical coverage policies. Children who are sent there involuntarily go through a couple of different paths. One might be an involuntary commitment process where the example of a child presenting to an emergency room, that might be eventually that child might be in a PRTF following that emergency room visit. The other example is if you do have child welfare involvement and they remove a child from the home, that is a high driver and predictor of placement in PRTF is child welfare involvement represents over half of the children placed in PRTF. So there's a correlation.
Holly Stiles is here on Due South. So is Paul Lanier, as well as Jason DeBruin. I want to focus on some of the reporting that you've done, Jason, across the last year. And I want to hear from somebody who has spent time in one of these PRTF facilities, somebody you spoke with. Her name is Arielle Wolf. Tell me a little bit more about Arielle.
So she's currently 30, and she's now a dog trainer. She lives what most people would consider to be a pretty normal life, and I've called that actually quite exceptional because most people, in fact, that spend time in PRTFs often end up in other institutions, prisons perhaps, homeless. And so the fact that Arielle is able to live a quote-unquote normal life is actually pretty incredible. She trains dogs, as I said, both for shows, but then also for as service animals. So she's even trained her own dog. She also, in addition to her bipolar diagnosis, she also suffers from Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is something that sort of affects your joints and bones. And so she has some pain and sometimes difficulty walking. And so she has a service dog that helps her just, you know, in some of those times of need. And it's somebody, it's a dog that she trained herself, which it's just a pretty cool story.
All right. Here's a brief portion of the conversation you had with Arielle Wolf as part of some of your reporting. And Arielle is somebody who is a former PRTF patient.
When I started really struggling with the preoccupation with death, you know, March 2005 was when I got pulled out of sixth grade because I was suicidal and, you know, just really not in a good place. And credit to my, you know, parents, especially my mom, for listening and being willing to prioritize me and my mental health over just like making me suck it up and deal. I was, you know, at 11 years old planning on jumping down the gym stairs, like taking a running start and just jumping, because either I would die and I wouldn't have to feel anything, or, you know, I would get hurt so badly that I wouldn't have to go back to school. And either way, it would be a win-win for me. Which, you know, looking at 11-year-olds, they're tiny. It's kind of heartbreaking to be like, wow, that was me. I mean, my self-injury had gotten to a point where it was dangerous to life and limb. I was really kind of flirting with the idea of death. I didn't really want to die, but, you know, I kind of wanted to get as close to death as possible just to see if I could understand it better.
That's Arielle Wolf. And Jason, you spoke with her as part of your reporting. To better understand PRTFs, psychiatric residential treatment facilities, just remind us, you said Arielle's 30 now. When was she in a PRTF? For how long? And you said she's living a somewhat normal life now. Was her experience in a PRTF a success?
The quote that really stuck with me and I think will stick with me for probably the rest of my life is that she said at one point, you know, I asked her effectively that exact same question, and she said that no, PRTFs were not good for her. She experienced a lot of trauma inside of a PRTF, but she's alive, and she's possibly alive or probably even alive because she was in a PRTF. And if you maybe look at that just in a vacuum, you could say, yeah, I suppose a PRTF was successful in the sense that she's currently alive and leading, you know, by all accounts, a normal life. But if you take even just one minor step back, I mean, if all a facility is doing is keeping a child alive, I mean, I think that we as a society can strive for a better outcome than just that, right? I mean, we should not accept that as a baseline, we're considering it a success if somebody is just simply alive. Right. I mean, we again, Arielle experienced trauma at the hands of PRTF. Her mom, that was a quote from her mom as well, that she experienced no real trauma except at the hands of a PRTF. And by the way, you know, we're talking about a lot of kids that experienced trauma before. Right. In many cases, a child might have witnessed some significant abuse from one parent to the other. Right. In some cases, even gunshots. I mean, we're talking serious abuse that kids are witnessing. That is not the case for Arielle. That was not her home life and not her experience. The majority of trauma that she experienced was after she entered a PRTF.
All right. I want to flip this thing on its head. We're going to hear from Arielle's mother in a few moments, maybe after the break here. But I think I want to flip this thing on maybe its head or ask for the other side of it, right? We don't have anybody from a PRTF here today. We don't have anybody from the state here today. But you all have used the word prison several times. And I'm thinking of recidivism. And I'm thinking of people who are incarcerated. The vast majority of people who go to prison come out and are, again, part of the real world. And as we think about rates of recidivism and people returning to prison, I'm wondering about rates of people returning to PRTFs and or what these folks say about, well, this is why it works. I mean, these institutions have been around for decades. Who is saying this works? And somebody is obviously saying this works, right?
Yes. And that maybe I'll kick this one to Holly. Some quotes that she gave me earlier that are sticking in my mind is that we have this institutional bias in North Carolina and that we are really changing the fabric of these children when they go in relative to when they come out. I don't want to take the words out of your mouth, Holly. Maybe just go ahead and pick it up from there.
Well, I think that's an important point to realize is that the use of these facilities does result in people going back to these facilities, right? We create kids who are on multiple highly powerful psychotropic medications. We restrain them. We put them in seclusion. We're drugging them. We're not treating them. And so, of course, when they are discharged, they're not better because we didn't actually treat the underlying trauma or cause of their issues. And then we maybe worsen them. And Dr. Lanier has the data and statistics about specifically how often kids go back.
We're going to take a break here in a minute, but I've got to hang on that word drugging. I mean, please go next level for me. I mean, this is prescribed medication from a physician. Who's on, like, have parents authorized? Like, just what do you mean by drugging? That's loaded to me.
And I do mean it the way I said it, that we use drug to manage and chemically restrain children. And Dr. Lanier's research, which he can speak more on, is about the incidences of how many drug kids are being prescribed.
And are parents okaying that? Are they signing off on this? Or by the time they get to PRTFs, has the parent been kind of removed from the equation?
One thing maybe to remember is that more than half of the children in a PRTF are in foster care. And so the guardian of that child is the state. It's no longer the parent. And so I wonder if it's maybe important first to just distinguish that you're asking about parents, but in more than half the cases, we're talking about the state actually being the guardian.
All right. We're going to hit pause for a moment. We're going to pick up the conversation on the other side. We're chatting with Jason DeBruin of WUNC, Holly Stiles, Assistant Legal Director for Litigation for Disability Rights NC, and Paul Lanier, Professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Social Work. This is Due South on listener-supported North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Please stay with us. Due South on WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. We're chatting about youth mental health this hour on the program with Paul Lanier, Jason DeBruin, and Holly Stiles. And Holly, I want to pick up what we were talking about before the break, this chemically restraining or drugging children. Please just pick up with the word drooling, which is a word that you just mentioned to me when we were off air.
Yeah, the number of medications that children are prescribed, and specifically psychotropic medication, so these are powerful chemical medication. They are used to manage behaviors, and so when kids have undesirable behavior, they get additional medications that are so strong that when we meet with them, they might have trouble keeping their eyes open, staying awake. It can cause drooling. And when you do a medication interaction checker on these drugs, it's startling how many red flags the interaction will flag for you. Like, why do you have three of the same type of like antidepressant? Why are you taking anticonvulsants when you don't have a seizure disorder? It raises a lot of questions about why these medications are being prescribed.
I'm coming right to you, Paul. But my question still is, at the end of life, oftentimes, there is a caregiver, there is somebody who is signed over to make medical decisions for somebody at the end of their life. Who is making the decisions for these children? Okay, half of them are in foster care. They don't have parents. But do they not have a guardian?
Yeah, so kids have, involved with foster care, have guardians, who are assigned to them. And this is why it's so important to have disability rights at the table, because they have such a unique insight into what is going on in these facilities. So, from the data, we can see things like 90% of these kids are on an antipsychotic medication while they're in a PRTF. We can see the high levels of what we assume is off-label use, using medications for, not what they're cleared for by the FDA. We see high levels of polypharmacy. So when we look at the data, we can just assume that there is a medical provider who is making a decision about, the best way to treat these children. But what disability rights can do, go in and look at some of these complaints and see the actual effects and what it looks like in practice to fill out the rest of the story. And just real quick, we mentioned readmission a while ago. So this is something we're looking at. So about half of kids in North Carolina, if they enter a PRTF when they're younger, 13, 14, meaning younger, about half of them come back into a PRTF at some point. So if these medications, if the treatments, et cetera, were effective, and you have this long period of time to figure out the transition plan and the treatment plan and to work with the family, et cetera, we would not see such high levels of readmission.
Two quick questions for anybody here. Roughly estimate how many children are in PRTFs in North Carolina, and for how long is the average stay? If we know, I'm curious and I don't know.
Pause. We do have that data. I'm trying to remember it off the top of my head. I'm sorry I don't have it right in front of me. Okay. I think there's roughly about 1,000. I think there's 500 new admissions and roughly 1,000 people per year.
Okay.
And the length of stay is in the neighborhood of 8 months. Am I getting the right? I shouldn't maybe speak out of turn. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, fortunately, I've got some of the numbers here in front of me. We've got a paper coming out in the North Carolina Medical Journal in May that will have all this data for folks to take a look at. But for the past 7 years in North Carolina, 2015 to 2022, we're talking about 10,000 children insured by Medicaid who enter a PRTF. Average age is about 14 years. An average length of stay can be about 130 days, but that can vary wildly where kids are there for 6 months to a year and much longer.
But that's 4 months and then beyond. Now, I want to turn to a little bit more of context and tape that we have from your reporting, Jason. Of course, 4 months, 5 months, 8 months with these restricted visitation mean that the patient, the person in the PRTF, doesn't get to see loved ones, if there are loved ones in their orbit. And conversely, parents don't get to see their children. Jason, you spoke with a parent. You spoke with Marsha, who is the mother of Ariel Wolf, who we heard from earlier in the hour. And we've got a little bit from your conversation with Marsha, the mother of somebody who is in a PRTF.
How do I get her help? How do I get her support? They're built like maximum security prisons. You don't realize that you are signing your child into a 24/7 lockdown facility. My daughter experienced no trauma of any real magnitude except at the hands of treatment facilities.
I am not perfect as a parent. I make lots of mistakes. If I were that parent, if I were a parent and I went to see my child who was dealing with something bigger and more challenging and severe than I had the bandwidth to even begin to help with, but if I felt like they were in a 24/7 facility lockdown, I mean, I would take them out. Or would I? Can parents take their children out once they're there? Or is this a sentence, so to speak, to go back to the prison analogy?
So a lot of children end up being involuntarily committed to PRTFs, meaning that it isn't within the parent control anymore because the court has deemed that the child needs the treatment. And the devastating thing that we hear from parents is that they would voluntarily consent to treatment, but because either for transport purposes, if you involuntarily commit someone, then a sheriff can transport them, they'll be involuntarily committed just to get transport. Or if a parent questions what treatment is being offered or says, I don't think a powerful chemical drug should be used to treat my child, sometimes they'll experience retaliation and an involuntary commitment will be thought to essentially take that parent out of the equation because somebody else knows better and thinks that a different method of treatment should be used. So there's a lot of different things that unfortunately remove parents from part of the decision-making process.
And I would just, you have to think about how powerless you feel as a parent in these situations, or even as, as a child where you have a guardian who may have 20, 30 other kids on their caseload, where you are trusting the experts, or you perceive as the experts about what's in the best interest of the child. And so when we think about PRTFs and other residential placements, and so I worked at one of these for 3 years, saw hundreds of kids and families and seen what it looked like. This is an arm of the troubled teen industry, and we have to think about the mental model behind this. We think back to the 90s and daytime television of a drill sergeant yelling at a child, trying to break them down as a form of coercive punishment as the avenue to treatment. We are in the same vein here still 20 years later that we think by punishing children and having these kind of really harsh environments to break them down is the pathway to successful treatment for them.
Jason?
And then just building off that, taking maybe a step earlier in the timeline, for instance, Marsha, Ariel's mother, was terrified, absolutely terrified that Ariel was going to hurt herself potentially so severely that she could die. And there just simply were not effective options that they could access in their home, in their community. And if there were better community-based supports, then Marsha would gladly have taken those care options and gotten Ariel the treatment that maybe could have been a lot more therapeutic for her without ever having to go to one of these facilities. And I think that's just sort of really big picture. One of disability rights' main points in all of this is we need as a society, as a North Carolina society, to invest more in community-based mental health care, particularly for young people, divert some of the money away from PRTFs, find the money, get the money from somewhere if we don't have enough, and prevent these PRTF stays to begin with.
Jason DeBruin of WUNC spent a year reporting on PRTFs with support from USC's Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. It was the 2023 Data Fellowship. He's here chatting on Due South. So too is Paul Lanier, professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Social Work, and Holly Stiles, assistant legal director for litigation for Disability Rights North Carolina. One lingering follow-up in my head before we get to your thought is, are these state-run facilities or are these private facilities that are making money and cash off of this whole setup?
There is one state-operated PRTF. The rest of them are private facilities. And we have to acknowledge the role of private equity in the problems that we're seeing. So private equity prioritizes profits over quality of care. And a lot of PRTFs are owned by private equity firms.
My mouth is, I need to pick my chin up off the floor, and I realize this will go out and people will hear this. I knew a little bit about this, and I've enjoyed your reporting, Jason, and I've learned more, but I'm having a hard time that we are having this conversation in 2024. This is somewhat astonishing to me, that private equity, I mean, private equity, say what you will about it, has nothing to do with the interest in improving children, children's lives who have psychiatric challenges. Paul, please take it away before I get in trouble. No. You were going to say something
ago. No, I could completely agree, and I'm glad you raised this issue, and Holly and Jason can speak more about some of these details. So there's, you know, national efforts looking kind of at the role of private equity and understanding where the incentives exist, you know, financially and otherwise, at multiple levels. So in terms of you know, who owns these PRTFs, these, you know, organizations, then thinking about, so it's not necessarily the staff, the people who work at them that we're concerned, there's concerns there for sure. But the incentives for those, you know, clinical folks on the ground are totally different than the incentives for private equity.
We've got just a couple more moments here on Due South. I want to try to be a problem solver and functional and roll this forward and talk about some reforms either that are being, and I'm going to throw a few things against the wall and you guys can take it away, that are being proposed in North Carolina that you as advocates are championing. If there are other states where you go, oh, they're doing it in a better way, this state has banned X or Y, I don't know what some of the potential answers are, but I want to shut up and hear from you all, please.
So one thing to mention is we expanded Medicaid, and that is a big step in the right direction. And one of the things that that has done is it has increased the rates that Medicaid mental health providers, the very providers that Holly was talking about maybe 40 minutes ago, those rates are being increased. And so hopefully that will incentivize some providers to enter the field. Now, I don't think that this is in any way a panacea, right? But it certainly is at least a step in the right direction. We also had a massive investment last year that the legislature approved of $800 million, $835 million actually, into specifically to fund mental health programs. Again, it will definitely take continued investment and more investment for even in the near term. I mean, $800 million is a lot of money, but it won't even solve all of our problems in the near term. But it is money that can at least sort of build on some pilot programs that have shown success. So DHHS has done some pilot programs in some small communities or county here or there where they do show that they can reduce PRTF admissions or placements, and they can actually improve mental health outcomes. But of course, these cost money. It costs money to pay a provider to be in a community, right? And so some of those pilot programs can be expanded. So I think
– can you go a little bit deeper for me on those pilot programs, these community programs? What does that look like?
So I hate to say the same thing over and over, but largely it's just qualified providers, people that can work with you know, what anybody would.
Social workers, child psychologists, pediatricians, who are we? All of the above?
Yes. School therapists, okay. School counselors is another one. But yes, absolutely, yes. I mean, one of the biggest things here is just people. It's sort of a manpower issue. There are other issues, I think. But I mean, I think largely we're talking about a manpower problem where we're not paying people enough and we're not incentivizing them enough to provide this kind of care. I mean, it's too easy for a graduate from UNC, that's a psychologist, to go work for BetterHelp, you know, or something like that, where they can live in Raleigh and they can do telepsychiatry and can make pretty good money, actually. Or they can go to a rural county in the I-95 corridor and work with, you know, difficult patients, right? I mean, which one is going to be more popular?
Paul, you're one of a team of UNC researchers who recently received a Creativity Hubs Award to improve mental health of children. I imagine this is a possible reform. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
Sure, yeah. So from the research perspective, this is a really understudied area. So we're trying to bring together, you know, a team of people from across UNC's campus to work with communities to identify these solutions that seem to be effective and make recommendations to the state. And this is a once-in-a-generation window of opportunity that we have because of Medicaid expansion, some of the decisions, the policies that are being made in our department to get this right. And so, as Jason's saying, it's absolutely critical that we stop referring kids to PRTFs. If you talk to them, they will say, we will go out of business if you stop referring kids to us. So we need to make sure that we have options A through Z available in every single community so that we cannot make the case that we've exhausted every single option when there's only maybe one or two that exist. So what we're doing in this research is trying to see what, through the data, what appear to be the most effective sets of interventions at the community level that can prevent entry into PRTFs in emergency departments and hospitals for our kids.
Holly, in the final moment or so here, what is the top priority or top priorities that you think need to be implemented or increased in this space?
Well, I want to be clear for all of your listeners that there's a real need, and this conversation is not denying or downplaying the mental health needs of children. That's not what this conversation is about. It's about how do we meet those needs in a way that is effective and provide treatment that will improve the child's life as opposed to further traumatizing them. And so there are examples that work. There are services that have been studied and demonstrated to keep kids who would otherwise be put in a PRTF in the community. So, for example, there's a very broad term of professional parenting. So, for example, therapeutic foster care, intensive alternative family treatment. These are models of people who have training, who have been, you know, screened and gone through this whole process, and they are ready and willing to care for children who may have mental health or behavioral health needs when their parents aren't equipped or aren't able to meet those needs. So there's also a psychiatric access line. Duke University has been doing this with DSS offices where they can call and get a psychiatrist to give them better information about what to do when they're confronting a child who's in a crisis. So there is hope, and our conversation today is about focusing on what works and moving past the things we know don't work and wasting taxpayer money on those things.
We unfortunately are out of time, but we will revisit this topic down the road, and I would invite all of you to come back. Jason DeBruin is WUNC's supervising editor for digital news. He spent a year reporting on PRTFs with support from USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism 2023 Data Fellowship. Holly Stiles is the assistant legal director for litigation for Disability Rights North Carolina. And Paul Lanier is a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Social Work and principal investigator for the school's Behavioral Health Springboard. Thanks, y'all, for the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Due South. Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Cole Del Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Quilla. For co-host Leonita Inge, I'm Jeff Tiberi. And remember, for more Due South, go to DueSouthRadio.org, download and subscribe to our podcast at Apple, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you do that on-demand listening. We'll talk to you again soon.